the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pahiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury, they shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: a Palestinian man dies in an Israeli prison several days after his arrest. Media reports say he succumbed to torture inside the prison. Syrian media say the country's air defenses have confronted an Israeli act of aggression in the western province of Homs. China rejects a World Health Organization plan for a second phase of an investigation into the origins of COVID-19. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story: a Palestinian prisoner has died in an Israeli jail, with media reports suggesting the man succumbed to torture inside the prison. Abdul Yusuf Al-Khatib Al-Tamimi was found dead in a cell in a prison in the city of Al-Quds. Palestinian media say Israeli prison staff severely beat him and used electric shock against him, but Israeli authorities say Al-Tamimi died of a heart attack, a claim the victim's family has rejected, saying he has had no pre-existing medical conditions. Al-Tamimi was arrested for driving offenses and leaves behind a wife and 4 children. He is the latest victim among thousands of Palestinians languishing in Israeli prisons, many of them without charge. Palestinian prisoners are kept under deplorable conditions without proper hygienic standards. Many of them are subjected to systemic torture, harassment, and repression. An investigation has reportedly found that an Israeli phone hacking spyware at the heart of an espionage scandal had leaked phone numbers used by 2 Dubai princesses. Media have identified Dubai ruler's daughter, Sheikha Latifa, and his former wife, Haya bint al-Hussein, whose numbers were hacked. They are among the list of some 50,000 people whose phones were leaked by the Israeli spyware known as Pegasus. The revelation has further raised concerns about Latifa, who in a secret video had said she was being held hostage and feared for her life. It was recently revealed that the Israeli NSO firm's spyware has been used to target activists and politicians, including some associates of murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE are among those received the spyware, despite being accused of human rights violations. Syrian air defenses have intercepted several Israeli missiles over the western province of Homs. A military source says the attack has only caused material damage. Our Damascus correspondent joined us earlier with more on the incident. Let's take a listen.
Syrian state media confirmed that there has been an Israeli aggression on Syria, particularly on the city of, on the governorate of Homs. The Syrian state TV also confirmed that the attack exactly targeted the area of Al-Qsir. Al-Qsir is a border town with Lebanon. It's just 8 kilometers away from northern Lebanon over there. No further details were given by any official source yet. However, usually a statement comes out from an official military source giving some details. What we know for sure is that air defenses were activated directly with the aim of intercepting the enemy missiles. Now, this Israeli attack comes only 24 hours after a similar one in which Israel attacked yesterday the area of Al-Sfira, south of Aleppo, targeting Syrian army positions over there.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says the Islamic Republic stands with the Cuban people and supports their fight against U.S. hostile and provocative policies. Majid Takht Ravanchi condemned decades of U.S. sanctions and blockade against the Caribbean nation, especially at a time when Cuba is facing a coronavirus pandemic. The Iranian diplomat described the U.S. policies against Cuba as a gross violation of international rules. Over a week ago, protesters took to the streets of the Cuban capital, Havana, after calls for demonstration on social media networks. Cuba blamed the show of discontent on Washington pursuing, quote, a policy of economic suffocation to provoke social unrest. China has rejected a World Health Organization plan to audit Chinese labs as part of an investigation into COVID origins, calling it arrogant and disrespectful.
This plan takes the hypothesis of China's violation of laboratory procedures causing virus leakage as one of the research priorities. From this point, I can feel the disrespect for common sense and arrogance towards science revealed in this plan.
Zhang added Beijing will not follow the proposal, saying it's opposed to politicizing the origin study. He said the Wuhan Institute of Virology has never designed, manufactured, or leaked COVID-19. He said so far the staff and graduate students of the Wuhan Institute have maintained zero infection of COVID-19. On Friday, the WHO proposed a second phase of studies into the pandemic origins, calling on China to be, quote, transparent and open to cooperate. China had earlier called on the UN Health Agency to maintain its scientific and professional positions in tracing the matter. Political commentator Inner Tangen believes the World Health Organization has been under pressure from Washington in its investigation into the origins of COVID-19.
Well, obviously it's under pressure from Washington. I mean, that has not been hidden. There have been complaints about the leadership and the organization. There's been nitpicking at its budget, at its role, etc. It's a shame. The WHO was the only thing that was, you know, a clear bellwether in terms of what was necessary to be done, and now they're attacking that because they basically failed the test of dealing with it in their own countries. China feels that it was burnt when it cooperated with the WHO COVID investigation, and they feel that this is just by many entities out there a witch hunt that is more interested in painting China in a bad light than it is at getting at the truth. So rather than deal with the politics, China's asking that only scientific bodies, recognized nonpartisan groups are involved in any kind of future investigations. And that these investigations not only target China, but look elsewhere.
U.S. provocations against China continue relentlessly. In the latest, Washington has accused Beijing of hacking the Microsoft Exchange email system. The U.S. is making the accusation as it has ramped up its hacking and cyber allegations against Russia. The question is whether U.S. is making such accusations with a political motive while making China appear like the bad guy on the world stage.
Tensions between the United States and China are rising once again. China has roundedly rejected the groundless and irresponsible hacking allegations made by the United States and its allies. Beijing says the allegations are fabricated out of nothing. The Chinese Foreign Ministry has hit back at Washington, calling the US the world champion of cyber attacks. Washington and several allies in Europe and Asia publicly accused Beijing of hacking the Microsoft Exchange server software in March.
Well, I would give the benefit of the doubt to China, given the fact that the United States is on a roll to build up all kinds of accusations against China, really to create an enemy image and to increase pressure on China with regard to many different political and economic issues.
Microsoft Exchange is an email platform used by corporations around the world. Senior U.S. officials claimed that hackers tied to China's Ministry of State Security carried out the hacking. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said that Washington and its allies hold China accountable for what they have described as Beijing's pattern of irresponsible and destabilizing behavior in cyberspace. They claim China's alleged hacking poses a major threat to the U.S. economy and national security. The United Kingdom and European Union have also joined the US in accusing China of carrying out hacking attacks. They claim the alleged cyber attacks have targeted an estimated hundreds of thousands of mostly small businesses and organizations. The US Justice Department says four Chinese nationals have been charged in a global hacking campaign aimed at dozens of companies, universities, and government agencies in the United States and abroad.
The problem is that the underlying dynamic here is increasing tensions between the U.S. and China, not because of China's actions, but because of U.S. actions, which often provoke a reaction. A reaction may be increased cyber attacks, but that the basic problem is that the United States is regarding China as a rival, possibly as an enemy, and that's creating a lot of conflict.
The accusation leveled against China by the U.S. is that Chinese hackers stole trade secrets and technology. It also alleges that China is sponsoring hackers outside of the government. Meanwhile, the U.S. itself stands accused of conducting the most hacking operations out of any country in the world. China says the CIA has hacked the country's aerospace research facilities, oil industry, internet companies, and government agencies over an 11-year period.
China and the U.S. are already at loggerheads over several issues. Last year, Washington took a harsh stance against Chinese tech giant Huawei, effectively banning the company from the U.S. Huawei is currently the world's largest telecoms equipment provider. Over the past few years, Washington stepped up arms sales to Taiwan, which is considered a red line by Beijing. Back in April, China warned the U.S. not to play with fire over Taiwan, as Washington moved to establish more diplomatic contact with officials in the self-ruled island. Tensions in the South China Sea risk turning into a full-blown confrontation between the two superpowers. The U.S. has already deployed 24 F-22 fighters to the Western Pacific as part of a military exercise in the Pacific Ocean. The deployment has been interpreted as a warning signal to China at a time when relations between Washington and Beijing have reached rock bottom over Taiwan and the disputed South China Sea. The exercise is in support of the 2018 National Defense Strategy, which called on the U.S. military to be a more lethal, adaptive, and resilient force to counter long-term strategic competition, primarily from China and Russia.
Well, they are going after the both China and Russia. They consider them the autocratic countries in the world. They want this association of so-called democracy, that is the Western world, controlling the rules of the road. And China and Russia have other views as to how the world should operate.
The South China Sea has also emerged as a flashpoint. The United States frequently sends warships to challenge China's claims over the disputed waters under the pretext of safeguarding the freedom of navigation. China is also on course to overtake the U.S. and become the biggest economic powerhouse in the world within the next decade.
Australian officials have warned that coronavirus cases could rise further as the country is struggling to contain a rapidly spreading Delta variant of the disease. The country's most populous state, New South Wales, reported 124 new infections, the highest in 16 months. Victoria State also logged 26 cases, a higher figure than a day before. The spike comes despite a weeks-long lockdown on over 13 million Australians, which has angered citizens. From the start of the pandemic, 915 Australians have succumbed to COVID-19. The overall caseload there is now hovering around 32,000. Authorities have been criticized for the slow vaccination process, with just 11% of the population being fully vaccinated so far. In Greece, police have fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse crowds protesting against mandatory coronavirus vaccinations. About 1,500 people took part in the march on the parliament in Athens against the government's COVID-19 inoculation drive. A similar rally was held last Wednesday and drew more than 5,000 people. The demonstrations were held despite Greece witnessing a surge in infections in recent weeks. Meanwhile, hundreds of people have gathered in France's capital to protest against the implementation of a health pass and compulsory vaccinations. Some protesters were carrying banners reading, quote, "freedom to choose and hands off my natural immunity." The protests come as the French government seeks to rein in the fourth wave of COVID-19 infections in the country. EU environment ministers say recent floods in Western Europe and extreme weather events around the globe must act as a wake-up call. Activists say the 27 country bloc's climate change goals are not ambitious enough. Jerome Hughes reports.
The cleanup operation continues in Belgium and Germany, the countries worst affected by last week's devastating floods following torrential rainfall. Senior figures from the European Commission have just attended a meeting of EU environment ministers.
50 degrees northwest Canada, 40 degrees in Siberia, 40 degrees in Central Europe. The floods you've mentioned, the droughts agriculture is dealing with, wildfires.
Last week, the European Commission unveiled plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the 27-nation bloc by 55% over the next 9 years. The Commission claims it's a matter of life and death.
The infernos and hurricanes we have seen over the last few weeks are only a very small window into what our future could look like.
Environmentalists point to what's happening right now. Raging wildfires in parts of the United States and Canada, severe flooding in regions of China, crippling droughts in areas of Iran, recent tornadoes in the Czech Republic. In order to save the planet, campaigners insist the EU must cooperate with big powers like Russia, China and Iran instead of pushing them away. Official data shows transport accounts for 29% of pollution in the EU, but one large ship generates as much carbon dioxide per day as 80,000 cars. Of course, the aviation industry is another major player, and so too is agriculture. Experts say the key is to cut our energy consumption and be more efficient.
Therefore, what energy a country uses, what sources, what does it burn? Does it burn coal? Does it burn gas, which has half the emissions of coal? Or does it do renewables, carbon-free sources? This is tremendously important for climate change.
Environmental groups say the EU needs to move faster and claims the bloc's goals are simply not ambitious enough. They are demanding that leaders agree on decisive action when they meet at a major UN climate change conference scheduled for October in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O Most Merciful of the Merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Neither COVID-19 is a permanent pandemic, nor does the rule of the Saudi Wahhabi have any permanency. Without the dangers of any epidemic disease and without the humility of obtaining a Saudi visa, the Hajj will retain its Abrahamic and Muhammadan spirit to unite Muslims on the common platform of monotheism. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading, Neither Corona is Permanent nor Occupiers of Islamic Sites. Stay tuned for more. The annual Hajj pilgrimage is the symbol of Islamic unity, of mankind's dignity, and of humanity's spirituality. It is indeed an excellent opportunity for the monotheists of a symbolic meeting with the unseen but omnipresent creator of the universe, who has cautioned mankind of Satan's sedition through such devilish tendencies as atheism, idolatry, egotism, and all sorts of evil ways that includes Zionism, Takfirism, Communism, and Capitalism, which has splintered the human race. Indeed, those who perform the Hajj pilgrimage, not as mere ritual, but with focus on the dynamic teachings of Prophet Abraham and the last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, are like those who have been born again. This means those who brag about their questionable claim to be the guardians of the noble sanctuary solely because they happen to be in military occupation of the cities of Mecca and Medina should know there is a big responsibility on their shoulders. They cannot call themselves Muslim yet divide the ranks of the Ummah on the basis of narrow sectarian attitudes and by taking the archenemies of Islam, such as the U.S. and the Zionist regime, as their guardians. This year, the Saudi regime of Riyadh, which is in occupation of the land of revelation, Hejaz, since 1925, has limited the number of pilgrims to less than 60,000 and restricted the Hajj only for those living within its political boundaries, but refusing to issue visas for the faithful from other countries. Glory to the Lord Most High. Neither COVID-19 is permanent pandemic, nor does the rule of the Saudi Wahhabi have any permanency. In other words, the future is bright for the Ummah. Without the dangers of any epidemic disease, and without the humility of obtaining a Saudi visa, the Hajj will return to its Abrahamic and Muhammadan spirit to unite Muslim on the common platform of monotheism. Even in the present conditions, when travel to Mecca is out of question, the faithful, wherever they happen to be, can adhere to the egalitarian message of the Hajj. And this requires throwing off the yoke of the U.S. and other hegemons. This was the gist of the message of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on this year's Hajj, when he said, "Today, our nations, our youth, our scientists, our religious scholars, our civic intellectuals, our politicians, our political parties, and our people must make up for that dishonorable, embarrassing past. They must stand firm and resist the aggression, interference, and wickedness of Western powers. Usurped Palestine is calling for our help. Innocent, bloodied Yemen torments every heart. The plight of Afghanistan concerns everyone. The bitter events in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and some other countries where the interfering, malevolent hand of the U.S. and its courts is completely visible is stimulating the zeal and determination of all the young people. Naturally, America and its courts are sensitive about the word resistance and have decided to show all kinds of hostility to the Islamic resistance front. Some regional governments' cooperation with them is a bitter reality that strengthens those malicious acts as well." These few paragraphs enlighten our minds and brightens our hearts to the Quranic principle of Bara'at min al-Mushrikeen, or disavowal of the disbelievers, a concept which was revived by the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him during the Hajj pilgrimage, and which the Saudis so brutally tried to suppress on the instructions of their masters in Washington and London. God willing, the coronavirus will be eradicated, and it will take along with it all the enemies of Islam, as well as the hypocrites who masquerade as Muslims to splinter the ranks of the Ummah.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Weight of chains. Part 4.
Where is the line between these NGOs and political parties? Aren't NGOs supposed to be the corrective factor of all levels of government instead of betting on who'll get into the government? The goal of these NGOs, however, was something else.
We all gathered ourselves pretty much on the same values and same goals that we thought would be good for Serbia for more than 10 years in different settings of us knowing each other more or less. And whenever we recruit new interims or whoever, we always refer them to our website, to our manifesto, and openly say that we are in favor of Serbian NATO membership.
But it doesn't stop there. These NGOs don't wait for citizens to become legal adults in order for those NGOs to start recruiting them or shaping their opinions on various political or social issues.
We have, for example, many educational programs now 10 years, mostly secondary school children and students. So we have human rights schools, which last 10 days. We gather children from all over Serbia, from different backgrounds. We select usually 30 children. In 10 days, and it's a very intensive program, they really change. In what way? They're offered a framework, a referential framework to think. You just have to guide them, to tell them what is wrong and what is good, what is evil, you know. So these elementary things, just to show them direction. They easily accept it.
Yes, children do tend to get brainwashed more easily. That's why NGOs don't waste time in making it clear who are the world's good guys.
The West is almost a synonym for democracy, for the respect of human rights and rule of law, for individual liberties.
But hey, I'm sure these NGOs can be critical towards the West as well, despite receiving money from them.
Do I think that the United States might be unfair sometimes towards someone? Somebody. Yes, yes, of course. No one is perfect.
Do you have any examples of that?
show. I don't know. Now I have hard times imagining the example, but maybe...
That's okay. It's not like the United States or the CIA ever admit to making mistakes either.
The United States and the CIA is one of its implements. Made mistakes and makes mistakes all the time.
Oh, so the former CIA director does admit that. But Dušan Gamzer can't think of any mistakes.
I don't know.
Talk about being more Catholic than the Pope.
Because they are technically non-governmental, whatever they do, the country that they're acting in, you can't accuse the United States of doing it because it's a non-governmental organization that is doing this subversion.
Some other countries knew how to deal with this. In 2012, Russian President Vladimir Putin approved a law which was previously cleared with overwhelming support by parliament, obliging NGOs that receive funding from abroad to register as foreign agents. The U.S. State Department quickly condemned the law, which was really odd considering that the U.S. passed a very similar law, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, back in 1938.
Today's threat to our national security is not a matter of military weapons alone. We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse, the fifth column, spies, saboteurs, and traitors. Our moral and our mental defenses must be raised up as never before against those who would cast a smokescreen across our vision.
The U.S. law requires groups representing the interests of foreign powers in a political or quasi-political capacity to disclose their relationship with the foreign government and information about related activities and finances. This law is still in effect in the U.S.
If America really is about freedom, democracy, and the rule of law, then it should be doing the same sort of thing in Saudi Arabia, but they don't. Let's have a look at the situation for women. They barely have any rights. Their rights in education is restricted. They're restricted when it comes to elections. So that just shows what Saudi Arabia is like domestically. But you could argue there's even a more sinister aspect to Saudi Arabia. It was Saudi Arabia that gave birth to Al-Qaeda, from 9/11 to Bali, to Madrid, to London, to Damascus. The roots go all the way back to Saudi Arabia.
Wow, from what this guy's saying, Saudi Arabia sounds like a horrible place. It must be on top of America's terrorist list.
Well, they're not at all on top of America's terrorist list. Saudi Arabia is one of America's closest allies in the world because of the business links there. If the Americans were so sincere about protecting and encouraging human rights in the world and democracy, there'd be an American naval flotilla off the coast of Saudi Arabia. It's one of the most wicked regimes in the world.
The foreign-funded civil society issue had little to do with human rights, and even less with democracy. In Introducing Democracy, a book written by David Beetham and Kevin Boyle, and published by UNESCO for the education of people in newly established democracies on human rights and political freedoms, it's said that an influence of an NGO on a government can be democratic only if it stems from mass membership, and not that which stems from the accumulation of wealth or power in the hands of a few. In Serbia, according to their websites or statutes, the Center for Cultural Decontamination had 14 members, the Helsinki Board for Human Rights had 9 members, the Humanitarian Law Center had 8 members, and the Center for Euro-Atlantic Studies had 4 members. As for the funding, despite these organizations practically framing the word transparency on their walls, they never were very transparent regarding how much money they received. So I did a little investigative work and sent out questionnaires to all of the sponsors of the organizations that I mentioned, asking how much money they gave to the NGOs. A few actually replied. This was just the tip of the iceberg. So much for mass membership with no accumulation of wealth. For a group of organizations supportedly promoting democracy at every corner, they weren't very democratic at all. at least by UNESCO standards. Some of the individuals working in these NGOs advocated full acceptance of everything the International Monetary Fund demands, despite the lessons from Greece, Ecuador, and many other countries.
I don't think West is enslaving us. I think West is liberating us. International Monetary Fund is liberating us. Accepting the terms of the International Monetary Fund are a step forward for Serbia.
The IMF serves the IMF. It doesn't serve any country. The IMF comes in like a vulture. It puts Serbia deeper into debt. That's what it'll do. So the people will be working for the international financial bankers.
Though compliant in the beginning, the first post-Milosevic Prime Minister of Serbia, Zoran Djindjic, eventually started realizing what the IMF, together with Mlađan Dinkić and a few other so-called experts, were doing to his country. In the last months of his life, Zoran Djindjic even attempted to sack Mlađan Dinkić from the position of governor of the Serbian National Bank, and Djindjic set up a plan to start returning Serbia's loans in 2006. This shocked many in international financial institutions and Western corridors of power. Sadly, Djindjic's plan was cut short. Zoran Djindjic was assassinated in March of 2003, and though a Serbian court convicted former paramilitary leader Milorad Ulemeklegija for the murder, the political background behind the assassination was never revealed. The next chosen prime minister, Vojislav Koštunica, continued Serbia's path towards integrations with the West, but he too at one point began to think that he could reduce Serbia's debt and get away with it.
In 2007, at one point, Serbia was in the process of lowering its level of debt.
By next year, Koštunica was gone. He wasn't assassinated, but his political career was, thanks to an unprecedented political and media campaign against him. Interestingly enough, many in Serbia who admire Zoran Djindjic today mostly do so because of his motivating speeches, which were, frankly, very impressive. In them, Djindjic advocated a change of mentality, telling Serbs that they all had to work together in creating a better society. But they knew little about his bitterness regarding Western plans for Serbia in the last days of his life. In his very last interview, Djindjic talked about the West as he rarely did before. This interview was almost completely ignored in every documentary about the life and work of Zoran Djindjic. With both Djindjic and Koštunica out of the picture, Serbia's debt started sharply increasing. The people were confused. They were afraid. It seemed that everyone was against them and there was no way out. Then, a ray of light shined through. Another one. 10 more. 12 shining stars. The European Union.
Europe is following a parallel of the United States. It's growing bigger and bigger. The Eurozone has allowed banks to become bigger, which is not a healthy thing for a regional world.
You do control your own currency. You can work your way out of excessive debt. Case in point is Argentina. 10 years ago, roughly, it was in a terrible economic crisis. It had followed all the rules of the neoliberal rules, the IMF, the World Bank. It was kind of a poster child, in fact. And it crashed. And what they did was essentially default on their debts. It's called restructuring. So they restructured the debts. IMF couldn't force the country to pay it. All the economists predicted it's going to be a hopeless disaster. For a couple of months, it was a serious problem. But then the country started growing again. Since then, it's had maybe the highest growth rate in South America.
Europe was a lovely place. Now, with this one Eurozone, Euro currency, I feel that it's like the United States. And I don't think these countries in Europe are like the states of the United States. They don't have an identity. Croatians are Croatian. Serb is a Serb. Italian and a Frenchman, a German.
All right, but I'd like to hear something from someone who actually lives in the EU.
I live in France, and dissatisfaction with the EU is growing tremendously. I say even in France, because, of course, the situation is worse in Greece, it's worse in Spain, it's worse in Portugal, it's worse in Italy.
Yeah, but isn't it important to you know, belong somewhere?
Well, it's always the idea that there are good standards in the EU and it will be good for the fight against corruption, etc., to adopt European standards. Well, I would say if it's good to adopt those standards, adopt the standards. I mean, if the standards are good, adopt them, European Union or not.
Ugh, that sounds like a lot of work. Can't someone else do it?
The fact is that belonging to the European Union has not been the great benefit to the existing members that it was promised.
In Greece, before 1981, before the entrance of Greece to the European Economic Community, the predecessor structure to the European Union, they were saying literally, we will eat with golden spoons.
It has not been the case because, in fact, the economic policy of all the countries is dictated by the bureaucracy.
Look what happened to Greece 30 years in the European Union. And not only this phase now with the economic crisis. We have no productive basis, no agricultural sector. We are importing everything. And the tourism which we have are not leaving really wealth to the people. This is tour operators. This is money which goes again out of the country.
Boy, this guy makes the EU sound like a Greek tragedy. Maybe the EU just doesn't like Greeks. What about the Croats? They recently joined the EU and love it. The Croatian president adores the EU. And that's because joining the EU made Croatia better.
No matter how much the Serbian government bows down to everything that the Europeans ask, they are still treated like they're doing something wrong.
No, no, you can't really mean that. Serbia needs the EU. It's the ray of hope, the last chance.
It seems to me rather sad that a country with the vigor, I think, intellectual and other of Serbia, for a small country, that it should pin all of its policy and hopes on getting into a club that apparently doesn't want it.
All right, fine. At least Serbia got a lot of foreign investments, right? And a small town in the south of the country was about to get a lesson in just how great foreign investments can be. Vranje had a well-developed shoe production company. Founded back in 1958, it started producing top-notch shoes, which quickly made it the leader in women's and sports shoes in Serbia, Yugoslavia, and the Balkans. The people were proud of their shoe company, and it was called Koštana, named after the title of a book written by Boris Stanković, a famous Serbian writer born in Vranje. At its height, the company employed 4,000 workers and had production facilities in several municipalities around Vranje. Unlike Sever in my hometown of Subotica, Koštana didn't survive the UN-imposed sanctions in the 1990s. It simply crashed. While some workers were old enough for retirement, many people who still could and wanted to make shoes couldn't find a job. Then a ray of hope appeared. In the 2000s, Serbian enterprising professionals in 8 factories revived shoe production in and around Vranje. The Sanj company was the largest of them, employing 552 workers, while another 68 businesses were involved in manufacturing leather products and shoes, thus employing most of the skilled workers who were left without a job when Koštana collapsed. Some companies received help from SIEPA, the Serbian Investment and Export Promotion Agency. The companies produced shoes for such European fashion brands as Nero Giardini and Moschino of Italy, as well as Louis Vuitton of France. The locals in Vranje showed that they could do good business and employ a lot of people without foreign management or investment. But then, Mlađan Dinkić had a brilliant idea. In a situation where the biggest local shoe companies had formed a cluster called Koštana, slowly reviving the glory days of the old company, here was Dinkić bringing in a foreign company, the Italian Geox, to compete with local companies. Fair enough, one might say. Some healthy competition couldn't hurt. The problem was that unlike the local companies, which received around $2,800 per worker from SIEPA, Geox received over $12,400 per worker from SIEPA. This allowed Geox to snatch up many workers from the local companies which were doing good business, and with them, snatched up the profits as well, and took them to Italy. The local shoe companies were no match for Geox, and their dream of reviving the pride that was once Koštana was fading away. The biggest foreign investment in Serbia is usually considered to be the acquisition of the Zastava car factory by Fiat. This is considered by many to be Dinkić's greatest success. However, despite the export of 117,000 vehicles worth around $2 billion, the local Fiat factory in the Serbian town of Kragujevac made just over $13 million in 2013. Since Serbia owns 33% of the factory, a little over $4 million belonged to Serbia. Considering the fact that Serbia invested $540 million into the factory, at this pace, it would take about 120 years to get back what was invested. The job is set so that everything is produced in Italy through Fiat's cooperators, while only the assembling is done in Serbia. If Serbia spends the money so that the profit goes to Italy, wouldn't it be more logical for Serbia to spend the money so that the profit stays in Serbia? What the example of Vranje showed was that locally grown industry could make it in the world market if properly stimulated. As the local companies were being foiled by their own government, unemployment started growing again. And for those who were too young to retire, but too old to find a new kind of job, it seemed that there was only one solution for their problems. Ilana Georgievska from UNIT, an organization that dealt with workers who lost their jobs because their companies went bankrupt following Macedonia's mismanaged privatization process. Macedonia, a former Yugoslav republic, unlike their counterparts in Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia, Serbia, and Montenegro, didn't experience wars or sanctions in the 1990s. The only armed conflict it experienced was in 2001, when Albanian separatists attempted a repeat of the Kosovo scenario. The Macedonians reacted, NATO stopped the Macedonian offensive, and a ceasefire was agreed upon, with Albanians getting many privileges but not allowed to secede. Dozens were killed in the conflicts, and it didn't affect the economy much. Oh, and the country had a very, very low suicide rate. And yet, more and more people were killing themselves in various ways. It was tough for Macedonia, and many who used to be the golden middle class looked back to Yugoslavia with nostalgia.
In the limelight.
The United States, which has exported weapons to the fake regime of Israel every year since 1961, is by far the Zionist regime's biggest weapons supplier. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Frank Andrews Ryder. This article is published under the heading Arms Trade. Which countries and companies are selling weapons to Israeli regime? Stay tuned for more. The United States is by far the biggest exporter of arms to the Zionist regime. Between 2009 to 2020, more than 70% of arms the Zionist regime bought came from the U.S., according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, Arms Transfers Database, which only includes major conventional weapons. According to SIPRI numbers, the U.S. has exported arms to the Zionist regime every year since 1961. It's harder to track arms that have actually been delivered, but between 2013 and 2017, the U.S. delivered $4.9 billion in arms to the Zionist regime, according to the UK-based campaign against the arms trade that is CAT. The US continued to export weapons to the Zionist regime when it emerged in 2009. For example, that the Zionist regime forces had indiscriminately used white phosphorus shells on Palestinians, a war crime, according to Human Rights Watch. In 2014, Amnesty International accused the Zionist regime of the same charge for disproportionate attacks that killed scores of civilians in Rafah, southern Gaza. The following year, the export value of U.S. weapons to the Zionist regime almost doubled, according to SIPRI figures. And under a security assistance agreement spanning 2019 to 2028, the United States has agreed, subject to congressional approval, to give the Zionist regime $3.8 billion annually in foreign military financing, most of which it has to spend on U.S.-made weapons. That's around 20% of the Zionist regime's war budget, according to NBC, and almost three-fifths of U.S. foreign military financing worldwide. But the U.S. also sometimes gives additional funds on top of its annual contribution. It has given an extra $1.6 billion since 2011 for the Zionist regime's Iron Dome anti-missile system, with parts that are made in the U.S. Andrew Smith of Qat told the Middle East Eye, Israel has a very advanced arms industry that could likely sustain the bombardment for at least a short period of time. However, its major combat aircraft comes from the U.S. Referring to U.S. F-16 fighter jets, which continue to pummel the strip, even if the capacity to build them exists in occupied Palestine, they would obviously take a long time to assemble. In terms of munitions, a lot of these are imported, but I'd expect they could be produced in occupied Palestine, he added. He said, obviously, in this hypothetical scenario, the tradition to domestically produce arms would take time and would not be cheap. The long list of private U.S. companies involved in supplying the Zionist regime with arms includes Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, Ametek, UTC Aerospace, and Raytheon, according to Qat. The second biggest exporter of weapons to the regime of Israel is Germany, which accounted for 24% of the Zionist regime's arms imports between 2009 to 2020. Germany does not provide data on the weapons it delivers, but it issued licenses for arms sales to the Zionist regime worth 1.6 billion euros from 2013 to 2017, according to Qat. CIPRI figures show Germany sold weapons to the Zionist regime throughout 1960s and 1970s and has done so every year since 1994. The first talks between the two regimes date back to 1957, according to Haaretz, which noted that in 1960, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion met in New York with German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer and emphasized Israel's need for small submarines and anti-aircraft missiles. While the U.S. has helped with many of the Zionist regime's air needs, Germany still provides submarines. German shipbuilder Thyssenkrupp Marine Systems has built six Dolphin submarines for the Zionist regime, according to Qat, while the German-headquartered company Renk AG helps equip the Zionist regime's Merkava tanks. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel voiced solidarity with the Zionist regime in a call with Netanyahu recently, according to her spokesperson, reaffirming the regime's right to defend itself against rocket attacks from Gaza. Italy is next, having provided 5.6% of the Zionist regime's major conventional arms imports between 2009 to 2020, according to CIPRI. From 2013 to 2017, Italy delivered 476 million euros worth of arms to the Zionist regime, according to Qat. The two regimes have done deals in recent years whereby the Zionist regime has got training aircraft in return for missiles and other weapons, according to Defense News. Italy joined other European countries in criticizing the Zionist regime settlements in Sheikh Jarrah and elsewhere earlier in May, but the country continues to export weapons. Canada accounted for around 0.3% of the Zionist regime's imports of major conventional weapons between 2009 to 2021, according to CIPRI numbers. Jagmeet Singh of Canada's New Democratic Party recently called for Canada to halt arms sales to the Zionist regime in light of recent events. Canada sent $13.7 million in military hardware and technology to the occupied Palestine in 2019, equating to 0.4% of total arms exports, according to the Globe and Mail. The UK, though not in Cypri's database in recent years, also sells weapons to the Zionist regime and has licensed £400 million in arms since 2015, according to CUT. The NGO is calling for the UK to end weapon sales and military support to the Zionist regime forces and investigate if UK arms have been used to bomb Gaza. The actual amount the UK exports to the Zionist regime is far higher than publicly available numbers due to an OPEC system of weapons sales. Open licenses, basically permissions to export, which keep the value of arms and their quantities secret. Smith of CUT told MEE that roughly 30 to 40% of UK arms sales to the Zionist regime are likely done under open license, but we simply don't know which weapons they are or how they are used. Private British companies that help supply the Zionist regime with arms or military hardware include BAE Systems, Atlas Electronic UK, MPE, Meggitt Penny, Plus, Guy's Control, Redmayne Engineering, Senior PLC, Land Rover, and G4S, according to CUT. What's more, the UK spends millions of pounds annually on Israeli weapons systems. Elbit Systems, the Zionist regime's largest arms producer, has several subsidiaries in the UK, as do several US arms manufacturers. One of their factories in